Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Produced by the iLab at WBUR, Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. What happens when you want to marry someone, but you're also falling in love with someone else? Is there a way for you to have everything and everyone? Sophie Lucido Johnson's essay is called Talking to My Fiancé About My New Girlfriend. It's read by DeWanda Wise. She stars in the new movie Someone Great alongside Gina Rodriguez and plays Nola Darling in She's Gotta Have It on Netflix.
Luke came to my front door in New Orleans on a sunny day several years ago with a sparsely decorated cassette tape and said, "I made this for you." I could tell this was a move he had used with other women, but I had to hand it to him. It was a good one. This wasn't the 90s when mixtapes were a popular medium for revealing a crush. Even mix CDs had come and gone. If you were going to use someone else's songwriting to convey your feelings, you did it with a Spotify playlist. I was charmed that Luke liked music and was obstinately analog about it. I'd only recently started dating Luke. We were doing that casual millennial thing that begins on Tinder and spreads into bar dates, sandwiched between bar dates with other people. I tended to be dating three people at a time, both men and women, and the lifespans of my pseudo-relationships averaged 2 months or so. I liked it this way. A capital R relationship seemed too big for my life, a concrete shape I had no room for. But when I listened to Luke's mixtape, I felt tricked. This was not a casual mixtape. It had folk songs about longing and soul music about feelings. It had Ain't No Mountain High Enough and Something by Usher. Luke soon revealed himself to be good not only at making mixtapes, but also vegetarian lentil stew and weekend travel plans to canoe through Lafayette to find armadillos. We approached and passed the 2 month mark before I knew what had hit me. 2 years later, we moved from New Orleans to Chicago and rented a one bedroom apartment. We established a night to have family dinners. We got cats. But I never wanted to give up dating other people, and neither did Luke. In Chicago, we maintained our Tinder accounts and would lie side by side in bed, swiping right, occasionally showing off our respective matches. Polyamory wasn't something my parents easily understood. My grandparents told me they felt truly worried for me. But nothing about our arrangement ever felt unusual. Most people I knew in New Orleans were non-monogamous. Being 20-something there implied that you kiss strangers at Mardi Gras. Before Luke, I had spent almost a decade building and prioritizing a close platonic friendship with my roommate, and she never minded that I went on dates with other people. Why should it be different with someone I slept with? In Chicago, we each dated only a few people. It's colder than New Orleans, so leaving one's apartment is less appealing. Sometimes I got jealous. Sometimes Luke did. We talked about our jealousy at length and afterward felt closer. 3 years into our relationship, we kept dating other people, but we noticed that the jealousy just kind of stopped. In the spring, Luke filled our living room with yellow daisies, and we got engaged. The next winter, at a party, I met Kat. She wore a skin-tight black dress with see-through keyholes on the sides. I couldn't stop staring. She was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen in real life. She was there with her boyfriend, Brendan, who was visiting from Portland, Oregon. And they were also polyamorous. I liked Kat, and I liked her boyfriend. We all exchanged numbers and said we would stay in touch. Months pass. I saw Kat at birthday parties and once at a gay rights rally. Over the summer, we ended up on the same camping trip with mutual friends along the Wisconsin River. At night, we laid on our backs with our shins to the bonfire. I moved close so our arms would touch. She took my hand. We waited for the stars to fall. I've always been scared of dating women. When attracted in the past, I have mostly gone emotionally limp, terrified of rejection. Women just seemed so untouchably beautiful. I was afraid that they could see through my foundation-wearing, hair-dyeing tricks and know instantly that I was not a suitable lover. After the camping trip, when I couldn't stop thinking of Kat, I drafted countless text messages to her that I never sent, until finally Luke told me I should ask her out. "Why don't you ask her out?" I said. "Because I'm not the one who can't stop talking about her." I decided I would ask her out by writing her an actual letter and sending it. The letter had a long list of possible dates and times when we might hang out, and I drew cats on the front of it to indicate how whimsical and carefree I was. 3 days later, Kat responded that yes, she was interested. I jumped around our apartment as if I had just gotten into my top college. Our first date was in my living room during a rainstorm. I tried on 4 outfits before settling on something that I decided would make it look like I had not tried on 4 outfits. I ordered enough Thai food for 6, forgetting that on your first date, you're usually too nervous to eat anything. Our conversation blissfully meandered. I tried not to look directly at her because I feared the depth of my crush was written all over my face. And Luke got home as our date was winding down. He joined us in the living room for a few minutes before leaving us alone to say the kind of goodbyes that linger a little too long at the beginning of relationships. That night, I lay next to my fiancé and told him about the woman I was falling for. People ask me why I'm getting married, considering my open approach to sexual fidelity. It seems that marriage, for most, is a contract where you agree to give up having sex with anyone else for the rest of your life as a sacrifice to someone you love. Which is a beautiful concept that works well for a lot of people, approximately 50% of the couples that try it. But for me, commitment has little to do with physical intimacy. I'm getting married because I want to promise, in front of my friends and family, that I am going to love Luke forever. I want to assure him that if he can't pay his rent, or when someone he loves gets sick, or if his car breaks down in an ice storm and he's stranded on the highway, that he can call me and I'll be there for him no matter what. I want to keep our family dinners going indefinitely. I want to co-parent our cats. More than anything, I want Luke to know that I will tell him the truth. And that when the truth is painful, I will stop what I'm doing and tend to him until he feels better. But I'm not going to promise him that our love won't change. And neither will he promise that to me. The fact that love absolutely will change is one of my favorite things about love. As the love changes, I hope Luke and I will be able to hold each other with compassion, that we will stay curious and empathetic. One night, after a December evening out, Kat walked me to the train station. Under the overpass, she pulled me toward her and kissed me in a small, sweet way that threw my stomach into knots. Our glasses fogged. We both wore gloves so thick we couldn't feel each other's hands. It was one of those fleeting rom-com moments you want to hang on to. Talking with the love of my life about falling for Kat has been an incredible gift. Luke pets my hair and lets me wax poetic in a way that most of my friends can only tolerate for so long. And it goes both ways. I root for him when he goes on dates. Kat says she talks to her boyfriend about me too. Right before Christmas, Luke and I went to Portland. My family lives there. We always head over for the holidays. And met up with Kat and Brendan. We all went on a date together. After it was over, Luke and I lay awake in my childhood bed, laughing about how sweet and strange and beautiful our lives were turning out. I know not everyone wants to love this way. I understand fear of loss. And I understand wanting to hold something still when it's good. Ultimately, this particular shape makes sense to me. Love as a blob that can't be pinned down, as something alive, an animal that ventures from person to person, but finds places to call home.
That's DeWanda Wise reading Sophie Lucido Johnson's essay, Talking to My Fiancé About My New Girlfriend. We'll hear how things are going for Sophie, Luke, and Kat after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Sophie Lucido Johnson's Modern Love essay came out this past October, on the same day as her wedding to Luke. Since then, she says that her love life has been pretty boring.
I love my husband. He's the most wonderful person who's ever been born, and I feel bad for everyone else who doesn't get to be married to him. Kat lives down the street from us. It was not by accident that we bought a house near her. Kat and Luke are close. Luke is dating a woman, Rachel. She and I are close. It's important to us that this feels more like a community than kind of like an experiment in sex. It's more about like love and sharing. It's kind of like life is a great weight, and you're asked to carry it alone, and you seek someone to help you share the weight. And why not seek like lots of people to help you share the weight?
Sophie says that for her, the best thing about polyamory is also the worst thing about polyamory. She talked with us just after her husband Luke went on a date with his girlfriend Rachel. And she told us that she felt jealous.
And I spend a lot of the morning kind of trying to deconstruct that jealousy and figure out like what's going on in my life right now that made today particularly vulnerable. And so for me, like the best part is being able to process your feelings all the time. But for a lot of people, and maybe also for me, that's the worst part too. Anytime an uncomfortable feeling comes up, you have to greet it and share it with the people in your life, which is super vulnerable and scary. But the rule is, like Luke, he doesn't say you shouldn't feel jealous, or there's no reason for you to feel jealous, or what's the big deal? You have other partners too, which is like the cultural expectation. He just stops and says, okay, that makes sense to me. Let's talk about it.
Sophie says that talking through those emotions makes her relationships rich and interesting, and that she's learned a lot about herself from her partners.
Polyamory is like not very much about sex at all. For me, polyamory is about like friendship and spending time with different people and letting different people fill your various needs and letting people be exactly who they are.
But there's a question. What happens when you want to have kids? Sophie doesn't have children of her own, but she did recently write a book about polyamory and interviewed a lot of women who do have children.
It was sort of like overwhelming how much everybody said the same thing, which is, I don't know how people have kids any other way. Because it's hard to have kids. It's a lot of work. I mean, I've heard. And these women who have been practicing polyamory sort of have an all-hands-on-deck kind of a situation where there's a lot of people who are involved in helping them to raise their families. And to them, that's an asset. Something I've been saying to Luke, my husband Luke, lately is that I don't think I want to have kids until we have other people who are interested in being a part of their lives.
And Sophie wants to make one thing clear.
I really don't think that, like, my way of loving is for everybody. I really, really think monogamy is beautiful. And when you make a sacrifice in your life to just love one person, that is like truly amazing. And I think it can really work. I think we just all are different. It's something to celebrate and not kind of push away. So I don't think the world would be better if everyone was polyamorous. I think the world would be better if everyone could be honest about what they wanted and felt safe expressing their needs.
Sophie Lucido Johnson. She's the author of the book Many Love, a memoir of polyamory and finding loves. She lives in Chicago. We've got more from Dan Jones and DeWanda Wise after this break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Dan Jones is the editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, and he says that over the years, he's gotten a lot of essays about open relationships and polyamory. It's a controversial topic.
Whenever we run a piece about open relationships where the person had a bad experience, we get responses from the sort of pro side saying, oh, don't run things like that. It's too one-sided. Don't run one-sided experiences. And then when we run a piece like Sophie's, where she does seem to be navigating it and is able to deal with that kind of ambiguity well, we get criticism from the other side saying, oh, that's ridiculous. Why are you promoting this kind of destructive behavior in relationships? My hope is that, you know, all these individual experiences form a whole, ultimately. These are all touchstones that allow you to figure out what is best for you. But every story is an individual story. It's not representative of society as a whole.
DeWanda Wise says that this essay resonated with her and fit with her character Nola Darling in She's Gotta Have It. Nola's in relationships with three different men.
And I just also believe in alternate ways of being and living. I feel like we're not presented with enough options. We don't see many alternatives. And, you know, I've been married for 10 years and my marriage has evolved, and a lot of my friends are married, and their marriages don't look anything like their parents' marriages. And, you know, I'm always interested in life as a living organism and something that's not necessarily finite or so, like, black and white. You know, I just believe in shades of gray.
Thanks again to DeWanda Wise for reading this week's piece. You can see her in the new movie Someone Great, and She's Gotta Have It on Netflix. Next week, Pedro Pascal.
Shannon has never heard my voice. She has never heard me berate a telemarketer or mumble to myself after making a typo. She has never heard me mess up a dinner toast or tell a corny joke. She has never heard me whisper into her ear or come up with a witty reply. She has never heard me ask a question or speak my mind to anyone. And she may never get to hear me do any of these things, but that's okay. Here is this lovely woman, devoid of judgment, who loves me for the words I type to her on my phone.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Special thanks to Samantha Hennig, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Additional music, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.